you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 181 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host once again. Today, we're going to do something a little different. Folks have been asking me, like, what is the best episode you've ever done, or the top three, or what should I go back and listen to? Those kinds of questions. And I never really had a good answer for that. And it was brought to mind when this past week, I reread a book called Friend of a Friend by David Berkus. Now, David was on our program way back in July of 2018 in episode 119. And I have to tell you, the book is phenomenal. And the interview with David Berkus is pretty good too. I should mention that's Professor Berkus. You know, instead of being kind of a fluff piece book, you know, one that, it's self-published, or maybe isn't much more than a long blog post. Friend of a Friend is a scholarly work written by a university professor, and it goes into the social research behind how we form networks amongst our friends and peers. And it's chock full of information about how we can leverage the understanding of that science to benefit our businesses. And I thought it was just a stunning book when I read it the first time. I reread it last week and think even more so, having read it a second time. And I thought, you know what? I need to rerun that episode so people are aware of the value of this seminal piece of work. So we're going to re-listen to David Berkus from back in July. And as I said, the book's called Friend of a Friend. You can find it anywhere that you buy books. And I hope you enjoyed the episode. Now, having rerun this, it does give me an opportunity to do a couple more announcements before we get started here. One is to remind you that in just about a month from when this episode airs, I'll be attending the Clio Cloud Conference in San Diego. And that's in early October. Late October, to be honest with you, October 21st and 22nd. It's a Monday and Tuesday, and you know I'm not a Clio user, so why would I want to go to this conference? It's just has a remarkable lineup of folks, and you know, look, if you're a Clio user, you really need to go, or it's a perfect opportunity to go because there's a whole track for Clio users, and you'll get a lot out of it. But even if you're not a Clio user, there's tons of information to be gained from one of the largest conferences in the legal space. And if you've been following the news lately, you know that there's some really big things going on within Clio in terms of funding and growth and where they're heading in the future. So they're worth paying attention to. So I'll be there 21st and 22nd of October in San Diego. Love to meet up with any law entrepreneurs who are in attendance. Maybe we have a cup of coffee or an adult beverage or something of that sort. So if you haven't already got it on your calendar, you've got about a month to go. So go to CleoCloudConference.com and get registered. And by the way, I get nothing for this. I have no financial relationship with the conference whatsoever. So it's just something I believe in and thought you would want to know about. And finally, just quick shout out to our sponsors again. You'll hear from them later in the program as well. But I wanted to thank Call Ruby, Ruby Receptionists. They've been with me for a long time. You know that they are my call receptionists virtual call receptionists. I use them, you know, every day. I couldn't run my practice without them. It's as big an endorsement as I can give to a company. And the other one is jurisdiction. And again, you'll know that I use them in my practice. They provide all my social media content development and help keep me on the straight and narrow in terms of trying to grow my practice. So I'm terribly indebted to them for any success that I have as an attorney in the estate planning space. So if you're interested in either of those two subjects, follow the links in the show notes and visit Call Ruby and or Jurisdiction. And now, without any further delay, long enough, let's re-listen to David Berkus. David Berkus, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm delighted that you could be here, David. Normally at this point, I ask my guests to tell our audience a little bit about themselves and how they came to be where they are. But in your case, I'm going to break the mold. And what I really like to do is say how it is I came to know you and got to the point where we could have you on. I was blissfully ignorant about so many things until I came across the Super Connector Summit that you did.
Oh, cool.
I think, it was a year or so ago?
Yeah, a little less, but yeah, about a year ago.
Yeah, so I came across that largely because one of my friends, Derek Coburn, was one of your guests. So I was following Derek around on the internet for a lot of times, and when he indicated that he was going to be on the Super Connector Summit, I tuned in, and I really loved the summit. And I will just tell our audience that we'll have that link in the show notes. And if you want to go back, I know you still have that content available. And so I love the model of that summit where you, on a daily basis, had these video interviews you did with movers and shakers. And so that was my first introduction to David Berkus. And then I saw your TED Talk, your most recent TED Talk on how to hack networking. And I thought, oh my God, this guy is really somebody I want to start and pay attention to. And I did some work with a lady by the name of Stacey Brown Randall, who wrote a book about referrals and has a course called Referral Growth Without Asking. And she draws on much of the same principles as you have in your work. So that led me to the bold chance of, I'm just going to do something that now I realize is probably not consistent with some of the things that you would refer to in your research. But I'm just going to cold call email this guy, David Berkus, and ask him if he would be on the show to talk about his new book. And lo and behold, you graciously agreed. So I want to thank you for doing so and let you know that the next time I'll be a little more formal about the process.
No,
I hope you're not offended by some knucklehead calling you out of the blue.
Oh, no. I'm so glad it worked. I actually, you never said that Derek Coburn was a buddy of yours. So we have a literal friend of a friend connection there. Derek's a good buddy, man. We, at least on a weekly basis, argue about something on Facebook. But we're like, I'm not the biggest fan of the Washington Capitals. And so that's what's dominating Derek's life right now. But yeah, no, I had no idea we had that mutual connection. That's really cool.
Yes. And I didn't realize how relevant it was until lately, when that discussion about the Washington Capitals was there. But as our listeners will soon find out, you are a lot of things. In addition to being a professor at Oral Roberts University, you're quite a prolific author and have written three books, the newest of which is Friend of a Friend. And that's the book that I just finished reading and I'd like to spend some time chatting with you about. I want to talk about the content in a little bit, but the structure of the book really appealed to me. You know, the chapters that you had, but more specifically, that each chapter at the end had a whole section on how to take the science that is addressed in the chapter and put it into practice. And then a second component was how to put it in practice using some of the online tools. I think you're very forward thinking in that approach.
And, you know, that was actually kind of a fight with my editor and me. So the interesting thing, so the whole sort of big idea for the book, right, is that networking is more about taking care of the network you're already in and understanding it better. And to do that, we need network science, but it's hard to put science into practice, right? So I knew automatically that we wanted to be prescriptive. We wanted to say, okay, now that you've, you know, learned about this particular phenomenon, here's how you can leverage it sort of individually. And my editor kept pushing back and going, there's not enough about online here. There's not enough about Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and all of this sort of stuff. And I kept pushing back and I'm like, that's because none of those things are effective unless they're a supplement to what you're doing face to face. They're not a replacement for it. And he finally was like, well, why don't you just put that then? And that's where we got this sort of separate out of practicing online. So it's not that like we deliberately did not start with any electronic technique. And then we went, okay, and now here's how this particular tool could help you do what you can also do face to face. So I don't know if it was me losing the fight, winning the fight, or if it was a draw, but somehow the argument with my editor is how we got into that different breakdown.
You probably won by default.
Well, I think everybody, yeah. Right? Because I think it's a really good way to break it down.
I think it's a really different approach because a lot of times you have kind of academic books or research books, when they try to show the practical application, they kind of get off on the wrong end of the spectrum and it becomes the wrong book, the wrong story. But yours, I just say, is true to its point, but is really concise and helpful at the end. So when I realized that that was the structure, you know, I started like a traditional approach to reading it, page one, page two. But when I realized that was the approach, I stopped and went and read the beginning introduction and the end of each chapter to get the whole flavor and the arc of what you were trying to do in the book, and then came back and finished the book in the traditional manner.
And I felt interesting.
I felt that was very useful to me personally.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's really interesting. It's funny. So I just, as a writer now, there's sort of an evolution to all of this where my first book, I wanted to do the sort of Gladwellian, just drop you in the middle of the story and then slowly drip out details that make it all come back together. And in my first book, my editor just pushed back. I'm like, no, you got to give a summary at the beginning if you're going to do that. That way people know what they're about to expect in this chapter. So again, that was not me. That came from good editing. And then we did that for sort of two books, but the missing piece that we allotted from the feedback was great. How do we put this into practice? Because exactly what you said, I am just sort of one of those people that's fascinated by social science research. And so I could spend my whole time going, wow, isn't this fascinating? And yet what we're actually trying to do with the book is sort of split the difference between a networking advice book and a look, this is how networks work. Isn't it fascinating? And so to do that, I mean, people do want the advice. I mean, fundamentally, I think it's something that there are very few classes on here's how to pay attention to your weak ties and to know who's one degree of separation out from you and really on how to sort of network except for things that are just one person's advice. And it's comforting when you don't know what to do. It's comforting to have someone say, step one, do this, step two, do this, et cetera. The problem is most people's advice isn't based in science. And so that then became the challenge for us. How do we lay out, here's a principle we know from 5 decades of network science research, and then here's how to put it into practice. We kind of had to do both. So it's really kind of cool to hear you say that and that it shaped the way that you read the book. Now I'm thinking about maybe I should have restructured it a different way to leverage that, but at least you figured it out, which is awesome.
Well, it's just one moron telling you that. So take that with a grain of salt.
One moron who happens to be in the exact target audience, which is people that know they need to pay attention to this, but just feel icky and dirty every time they read somebody else's advice book on it. So, you know, that's a pretty valuable moron's advice.
I will tell you the one other thing before we get into the content of it that I really liked is, and you use the word network research several times there.
This Too much. Book, yeah.
This book is footnoted like a law school journal or legal brief. And I, you know, speaking for a lot of attorneys, I like that. Because so many times I read a book and the author will say something like, well, somebody said somewhere, and they'll paraphrase a quote that they think they heard, and they'll build a whole chapter around that. And it's like about sourced or anything. There's a ton of research in this book. Your whole life is research, and yet it reads like a novel. So it's a delightful book to get into.
Well, thank you. So that's another fight between how do you put the endnotes in and all that kind of stuff. Because I want to do them as footnotes, like at the bottom. You can just see this is this study, but that would look too textbook like, right? So we compromise, and then other people wanted to take them out entirely, but we compromised on EndNotes, because I'm the exact same way. I read something fascinating, I immediately flip and like, where did this come from? I want to go get a copy of it.
Yeah. Well, I will say that I think reading it, you know, on my tablet, my iPad, made that a little simpler.
Oh, good point.
And more useful. But in any case, let's talk now. My challenge here is going to be able to limit this, because I think I could probably spend the rest of the afternoon chatting with you. But let's talk about a couple of key things, at least from my perspective, about the book. And right off the bat, first off, you start with a great story about one of my passions, UFC, and the Dana White story.
Which you and me both.
So you hooked me in the first two paragraphs, okay?
That's good.
But the first chapter talks about something that is just so difficult for, I think, us attorneys to get our arms around, and that is the strength of your network is not in your first level connections, and maybe not even your second level connections. It is those weak ties, those dormant ties to long lost friends. Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think a lot of us instinctively do this, maybe not just attorneys, but sort of definitely so, that you have your close contacts, right? Your people that you talk to every day or every other day, you know, your family, your coworkers, if you have them, right? Or just people that you rely on for advice and you're in frequent kind of communication with. And then what's weird, somewhere along the line, networking, right? I'm doing air quotes. I hope you can hear them in my voice, because you certainly can't see them. But got thought of as meeting strangers, right? As getting new people into the list of people that you already know. And so we use this term in the subtitle, hidden network, to refer to exactly that. If you have gone through any stretch of a career, really, so long as you have sort of that you're an adult, you probably have more people that are in the weak or dormant tie category. Like you said, long lost friends, but also colleagues that you changed jobs, or, you know, you went solo and they're still working at a larger firm or what have you, that we lose touch with. And you usually have more of those than you have people you keep in touch with on a regular basis, those close contacts. And from a pure network science perspective, they are, if we were to map out the entire network that you're already around, they are much further away distance-wise than your close contacts. And the people that they are then close contacts with are different from the people that you're close contacts with. And so for that reason, they have access to different information, different perspectives, different potential referral sources, right? Or even just different ways of kind of looking at a problem-solving issue you might have. They're actually more valuable to you when what you need is something new information-wise than your close contacts. You already know what your close contacts are going to say. You all talk to the same people. You all read the same stuff, right? And that's valuable for what's known as sort of bonding capital. But for new information, which is the ultimate kind of reason for paying attention to networks, that comes better from those people that are a weak or a dormant tie. And so, like you said in the book, we use an example of this, which is Dana White and Lorenzo Fertitta. And I'm going to butcher the story for the sake of time. But what not a lot of people know is that they weren't just two guys who worked in the fight game that went into business together. They were long-lost high school friends or high school acquaintances until Dana got kicked out of high school. And they went on sort of this long, circuitous route until about 10 years later, they're reconnecting at a high school friend's wedding. They're finding out that they both like MMA. I like to think of it as like they do that thing that we all do where you meet a long-lost friend and be like, oh, yeah, we should do this again sometime soon. Except most of us don't ever do that, right? They actually did, right? Because a couple weeks later, Dana finds out that the original owners of the UFC, the people that founded the company, are not happy with it and looking to offload it. So he calls up Lorenzo, because Lorenzo's the only billionaire he knows, and he says, hey, I think the UFC is for sale and I think you should buy it. And over 20, 25 years together, they turn it from a $2 million acquisition, they put more money than that into it, to a company that they sold for $4 billion, which is the same amount of money that Disney used to purchase Lucasfilm and all of the Star Wars properties. So that's a pretty decent take from just meeting some weak tie at a high school friend's wedding.
Exactly. And one of the points that you make about, and I see it manifest itself often when we as attorneys want to expand our network. And the thing that we do is we go to bar association events and we end up talking to the same attorneys. You know, or people who are in the same relative business as we are. And then we're surprised that that doesn't blossom into something more than just meeting other attorneys. Now, sometimes business can result from that. But you make the point very clearly that if you want to have a broader reach and expand the scope, you got to talk to people who aren't doing the same thing you're doing or aren't in the same silo that you're sitting in.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you know, this is actually one of the broader problems with those sort of networking networking kind of events or things like that. They actually, if you look at them as a way to reconnect with weak and dormant ties, they can be effective. But the research is actually pretty clear that you're not going to meet new people there. You might meet one, but you're going to spend way more time with those same close contacts, the people that you are comfortable with. And so I find them a relatively ineffective event as a whole for that reason, because you're not meeting the strangers. And a lot of people are just spending time with those close contacts. So I think it's better to develop a habit of constantly checking back with those people. Make a list of people that you, even if you don't want to make a list, I think getting the discipline of taking when someone you haven't talked to in a while pops into your head, taking the 30 seconds to send them an email or a text or a Facebook message if that's the only way you're connected to them, or a LinkedIn message if that's the only way you're connected, and just saying, hey, I know we haven't talked to each other in a while, but I was thinking about you today because blank, and just wanted to see how you were doing. It's a really simple email, and I've never met someone who received that email from someone and hated the idea that someone else was thinking about them, right? So it's a well-received email as well. And you don't know where it'll go from there. But if you kind of get in that habit of regularly reaching out to those people, it can go to some really incredible places. You might not found the next like fastest growing sport in America, but I'm willing to bet you will see an ROI eventually.
Well, one of the things I think that happens as a result of that, I know I'm guilty of all of these things, you know, in spades, is you start collecting business cards, you start collecting entries in your database, and you fill it up. And as you go on to say in your book, it's not really the who has the best connections or who has the most extensive connection database, or as we used to say back in the day, the biggest Rolodex, but it's who can see, who has visibility into their whole network, and who those people are.
Yeah, I mean, I would totally, of course I would agree with that because I wrote it, but I would also agree with your interpretation of it. To think about the Rolodex idea, I think there's this tendency to think that bigger is better, and that leads to a really transactional level of networking. If you're just trying to collect the business cards, I mean, like, you're that sleazy weirdo that everybody tries to avoid. The interesting thing is there's no evidence that says you actually need them, right? So in the book, we talk about, we start off talking about sort of the 6 degrees of separation phenomenon and how the whole world really is 5 to 6 degrees of separation apart from each other. But why I think that matters for us as individuals is that 1 or 2 degrees of separation out from you is probably everybody you need to get connected to. And it's not a question of like trying to meet as many people as you can, even when there's no reason to stay in touch with them, is a far less effective strategy than just seeing the network and the fringes of that network and knowing that, oh, if I ever actually wanted to get into doing work in intellectual property, for example, I have this person, and then I could ask them to introduce me to other people. Just knowing who the route that you would end up taking if you wanted to go, that's usually enough, because the worst thing you can do is build out that Rolodex with people that then when you finally reach out to them are like, who are you? I haven't talked to you in 6 years. You're basically a stranger again.
It happens all the time. I go down my list of people I've met at a conference and I haven't made a good note, or I haven't really made a good connection, and I can't think of why they're in my database.
And so that's a reason not only to do the thing where we make the point to reach back out to weak ties frequently, so that 3 years from now, it's not an awkward conversation.
Right.
But it's also another reason to just, you don't need to be so focused on meeting lots and lots of strangers. I think if you hate the idea of staying for that cocktail hour after the conference, you don't have to go to it. There are useful things you can do at it. So we could go down that route. But if you're also, if that weirds you out and that's inauthentic to you, don't go. Reach back out to your weak ties. Get used to introducing people who are already in your network. Get used to asking for introductions. You can kind of, you know, unlike Neil who sent me a cold email, you can kind of work through warm connections and referrals for all of the network that you actually need to access. You just have to learn to stop seeing your network as a list of contacts on your phone and start seeing the network that you already exist in.
And when you then broaden the development out to filling some of those holes and making some of those connections, law is my fourth degree now. I'm a fourth career. I got started in this business late. But in a previous technology career, you know, organizations were very often structured hierarchically on the org chart. And it seemed there was a whole industry built around, well, let's think of this as a matrix organization now, not along these vertical silos, but project teams across those verticals, or a horizontal slant. You make the point in the book that connections between these groups of folks and understanding how to plug those gaps is really the key to developing a robust network.
Yeah, and I think the point too is not, I mean, the matrix organization was an interesting attempt at solving that I think didn't realize that people are always going to cluster. We're going to cluster by background, by interests, by function, right, and what have you. And even if we try and give everyone six bosses instead of one, like, they're still going to be clustering. The point isn't to totally turn around your weird siloed hierarchical organizational chart and make it look like a piece of graph paper instead. The point is to know that you need to have brokers that are able to bridge those gaps. And you don't actually need that many of them across different teams. Where I think this is interesting too is for the individual, you know, you're thinking, all right, well, I'm not a part of a 10,000 person organization. There's an individual component too, which is that you unlock a tremendous amount of value for the people around you. And then that has a spillover effect to you when you are that broker. So, like, I mean, Neil, I'll use you as an example. Law is your fourth career, but one of the things that you saw right off the bat was, hey, there's a lot of people who aren't actually taught how to run a business. And so you're connecting the legal community that was learned how to be a great attorney with, okay, you didn't necessarily learn how to run a business. So let me bridge. These are two different clusters, the entrepreneurship cluster and the legal cluster, that you are then that structural hole for. And it's, I mean, I assume it's created a lot of value for you, because I know you've created a lot of value for the network as a whole. And so it can be that way too. What is that thing where I can bring two communities together and then be that source of flow of information, and also that person that, you know, helps protect any of the property, the value that's created, because we're using the legal profession. But what can I do to connect those two clusters, and what two clusters can I connect is probably the first question that anybody should ask. And then going and doing it unlocks a tremendous amount of value.
Yeah. And for me, it's interesting when I was reading the book, because, you know, almost identical to what you just said, that I see that ability or that occurrence happening between the legal community and the others that I bring on this show. But if I just examine my law practice and I think about networking within my law practice, I don't have the same approach. And when I was reading the book, I went, well, why am I doing it the right way or the way that seems to be reflected in this book? When we're talking about the merging of the law practice and the podcast, but solely within the law practice, I'm not being that aggressive, or I'm not being that complete, is really a more accurate word, in the process. So it really opened my eyes to that.
Yeah. Well, and I think too, especially if for those people that are listening that are in a solo practice, especially, like, you can't possibly be all things well to your clients, there's probably going to be a need to just understand kind of the network of who else they need to be interacting with, whether it be other attorneys or whether it be other sources of information, right? Or other professions and practices. Like, it's weird, as I get older, I'm seeing probably the one sector of the legal community that I think is doing this well is when you get into wealth and estate planning, there's an understanding there that I also need to be connected to people that work in a couple different industries. I don't know that we do it as well in a variety of other practices that even just get that bridging the gap between this type of law that I practice and the other people that run up against or interact with those clients, that if I already bridge that gap, I can be of service. I think even that, and I think a lot of it, you know, to be honest with you, a lot of it stems from kind of the system, right? The system right now is designed, you go to law school and it's so, and in law school, you learn how to climb up this ranking system to be the top student. And then you go, you've racked up a ton of debt. So a lot of people go to work for the big firms, where the whole goal there is to sort of schmooze and work your way up and hopefully eventually kind of get partner track, but you either, if you don't take that route, you've got the law school teaching you to work through the system and work up. And then if you do take that route, you've got law school compounded with this, where what you're not learning is breath and bridging that gap. You're learning to stay in your cluster and just be the alpha in that cluster. And that's a really bad strategy when it comes to running your own business. It's the exact opposite of what you need to be doing.
Exactly. And one of the challenges that I think we have as attorneys is how do we bridge that, those connectives, those people in my network? How do I bring them together? Because I know for me, introducing one member of my network to another kind of felt artificial to start with, until I started following some advice of people like Derek Coburn and Stacey Brown Randall. And you talk in the book about the science of connecting people and how that manifests itself. Talk about that for a couple of minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that, certainly just randomly, just pulling like roulette and randomly introducing two people because you drew their number is not all that effective of a strategy. But there's really something to be said, not only from that. I mean, Derek does a great job of sort of here's how to structure the events that kind of do this. I think the real science behind it is just in a, if we think again about a network, not as something you have, but something you're in, and we start looking at it as that broader community that we're serving and that we're a part of, et cetera. There's a really interesting rule in any network called preferential attachment, which is a fancy term. I actually think of it a lot like gravitational pull and like mass. And that's not just because a week ago I was reading a book about how planets are formed, but it's a good analogy nonetheless. You get to sort of a certain critical mass, and then other things are kind of drawn to that thing or into the orbit of that thing. Preferential attachment works the same way. Inside of a community, the people who are the most connected are going to, they're kind of in the center of the physical network if we were to draw it out. But they are going to be statistically more likely to get new introductions. And the easiest way to start sort of migrating towards that center is to be generous with the network that you already have and already begin to connect the people that you know around you. And I don't think it's a question of just doing it randomly. But again, it's kind of like reaching back out to weak ties. I think it's a matter of a lot of times when we meet new people or rewarming a weak tie, or even just in a conversation with someone that's a close contact, a lot of times we're focusing so much on either A, what we're going to say next, or B, can this person help me or can I help them? And then we're sort of a missed connection because, oh, I can't help them, they can't help me. But if you think about the totality of sort of the people that are you're connected to, the odds that there's someone there that could help them is much different. And so I coach a lot of people to just start getting in that habit of when you're talking to someone, be thinking about who else do they need to meet that I know that could help them solve their problem. And then speak up and actually say, hey, you know, I think you should really talk about this with my buddy Derek. Would it be okay if I reach out to him and see if he would be willing to connect with you? Now, there's a very specific reason I said it that way too, which is to practice that sort of double opt-in introduction. Make sure you're not blindsiding people with introductions. But the bigger lesson is that habit to me of just getting into the point of be generous with your network and your connections. And then not only does that kind of gravitate you to the more connected, more center of the network naturally, it also lets people know that, okay, you know, Neil is generous with his connections, so I should probably be generous with mine with Neil's. And then you start to leverage that preferential attachment.
When I read that part of the book, I was thinking about, it's kind of an extension of when you meet someone at a cocktail party and you start doing the bit, who do you know here at the party? How do you know the hosts? And then you start branching out from there. Oh, well, do you know so-and-so? It's the moral equivalent of that.
Yeah, kind of. With the stated intent of, okay, if there's a purpose, let me connect you with so-and-so if you don't know so-and-so, right? Those are all questions that we ask. What's interesting, too, is we instinctively do this, like to use the cocktail party as an analogy, we instinctively do this in personal or what I would call friend mode, parties. Yeah. Right. Like I was at a graduation party for a buddy of mine who just went back to graduate school and just graduated. And, you know, that's the question more than anything else is, oh, how do you know Brian was his name in this case? And then we use that to kind of map the network out. But then we flip to a professional and we don't even ask that question. Think about the question that we ask when we're in a more professional setting for a networking event. We ask, what do you do? which has no information about the connections around you, right? And then immediately people then go to their script, they practice their little elevator pitchy thing.
And then there's a blaze over.
I know, right? but then there's a missed connection because the likelihood that what you do and what they do is an immediate need for each other is so much smaller than the likelihood that you'd are connected to someone that they need to be connected with for this sort of reason. So what we're doing in the friendship network works better even in the professional network. And now we've actually stumbled across the secret reason that the book is called Friend of a Friend, because I would rather us just think about it like there aren't work contacts and friends. They're all just friends. It's all one network.
Well, you make this great point. And again, I find attorneys, and I did the same thing in the beginning, we try and keep that separate. And it manifests itself most clearly in, I'm going to say, on Facebook. And you'll hear attorneys say, well, you know, I keep all my professional contacts in LinkedIn. And I keep all my personal contacts, you know, stay in touch with them on Facebook. And never the two shall meet.
Yeah, I mean, if you can hold that line, that's great. Most people try that and then it doesn't work. Yeah, for a very simple reason. In network science, we talk about this phenomenon called multiplexity, which is more than just a fancy word. I mean, it's a legal fancy podcast, so we're going to have to throw in some multisyllabic words, right?
Exactly.
But multiplexity refers to the context for connection that people have. So a uniplex tie is the opposite. It's just if you're just a work friend or you just see each other at running club every Thursday night, right? If there's only one context for connection, that's a uniplex tie. A multiplex tie is when there are a couple different contexts for connections. Yeah, you work together, but you also both love running and your kids go to the same elementary school. So you see each other at fundraisers, right? There's multiple different reasons to connect. And the research is strongly suggestive that you build a deeper relationship faster with someone when you build a multiplex tie. But the other thing I think that happens that's really interesting is that having multiplex ties, having real friends that butt up against your work life actually makes you a better performer at work too. So we see this in organizations. We see people who have more multiplex ties inside the company, meaning they have more real friends at work, are better performers. It's interesting. They're also going to bring more drama into the workplace. So there's that, but that gets offset by the increase in performance, right? So it's annoying, but it's worth it. Right. And then we see it in, to use an entrepreneurship setting, it's much more likely when you've got a multiplex tie that somebody who started out as a personal contact for some reason becomes someone you go into business with take on a client relationship with, et cetera, than the other way, that people migrate from being work friends to real friends. So that, by all means, that doesn't mean like spam your friends with a letter advertising your services, but be open to the idea that we should be getting to know people from multiple facets. And if a work friend develops into a real friend, that's great. If a real friend develops into a work contact, that's also great. The way that I've learned to sort of say this now is that humans are multifaceted and you'll have much more success interacting with them if you're multifascinated with them.
Well, one of our guests recently, Sabra April, we talked about her use of Facebook, because one of the questions I ask is how do you use social media in your practice. And she made the point that I include some of my business related activities on my personal Facebook page because my business is me and I am my business. And as long as I'm just not overdoing it, then it's good for my clients to see my personal life and my friends to see my work life.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I would largely agree with that. I have, what's interesting is everybody has different rules, and that's one of the reasons these tools don't work as effectively as I think their creators would hope, right? Because I'm sure if we asked, Mark Zuckerberg would tell you the right way to use Facebook, right?
Of course.
And I'm sure 1% of people who use it that way, right? Same thing with LinkedIn with Reid Hoffman. I could ask him and same thing. So I have a little bit different rules in that it's not really a work versus personal thing for me. To me, it just boils down to, am I comfortable with you looking at pictures of my kids? That's literally my gut check thing. And if you're a work contact, but I'm comfortable with that, cool. great. Come on into my personal network. I'm going to post the Blender stuff anyway. And if I'm not, then I, you know, won't say yes to that. I've LinkedIn, I'm very different because, again, being a writer, et cetera, I've sort of, if you send me something, if you send me a request, I'll accept it. And then if you spam me, I'll block you. But if you send me a request, I'll accept it. But for me, for Facebook, that's the one. It's not a question of work or friend thing. It's that. If that's the circle of intimacy that you're now inside of, that I'm cool with you. My kids are 6 and 4 too, so I'm super protective of them at this age, especially. If that's the one, then cool. And I don't care which way we know you because multiplexity.
And you then extend that a little further and you talk about skipping the mixers and sharing activities instead. And I think this is something that Derek does magnificently with his group here, Cadre, in the DC area. You know, we're going to all have a good time together. Oh, and by the way, if business flows from those relationships, that's great, but that's not the reason we're getting together.
Yeah. I mean, so peek behind the curtains, Derek was actually supposed to be in this chapter. But then we had kind of, the editor was sort of like, oh, we've got this, we have these two people that plan dinner parties and that works great. And then we've got like the corporate angle. So we've, he was like, I don't see what we could add by doing another story that, around this. So, but you're absolutely right. If you're in the DC area and you know what Cadre is, it's a very powerful way to plan what most people would just call a networking group, but it's not. It's so much more than that. So to nerd out on the science real quick, I already sort of hinted at some of it, which is that when people go to an unstructured networking event, meaning there's no other reason to be there other than get to know people. I like to call these the speed dating for professionals events, right? When you go to one of those, you will spend more time with the few people that are there that you already know. And if you know no one, you'll spend the most time either by yourself stirring your drink in the corner or with people that are very similar to you. And that's something we know from literally tacking RFID tags onto people and tracking who they talked to. So we know this is true. Alternatively, if you're engaging in what the sociologist Brian Uzi calls a shared activity, something where there's some other reason to show up than just meeting new people. So it could be raising money for a charity or going on a run, like I used running club earlier. For me, again, because MMA is my thing, I'm also into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I've been training it for 12 years and that's my shared activity, right?
Yeah, good for you.
Draws a lot of people that they're from diverse communities. There's something at stake. There's a reason to have to work together. And at the end, it takes you away from your script. So that what do you do question is kind of irrelevant to accomplishing that thing. So Cadre is a great example because Derek's sort of always planning other events. He also, if he's planning smaller things, he talks a lot about sort of the plus one rule. So he won't say like, oh, I'm going to run a dinner party for 12 people. He says, I'm going to do it for 6 and then ask everyone to bring a plus one. And so the whole purpose is people that already know each other to each bring that kind of new person. That's one example. My favorite example, and it's in the book, is a writer friend of mine, John Levy, who plans these dinner parties where people show up and they find out that, okay, you don't know anybody else and you actually are going to have to cook. Yeah. You're not just here to eat, right? And
story.
You get paired up with a stranger, right? And then John says, don't share your full name and don't say what you do. And now let's get to cooking. And it gives tasks to everybody based on those pairs. And you know, there are stakes. It's not high. Like if you burn the chicken, it's not the end of the world, right? But there are stakes that make you have to kind of interact with that person in a way where your script wouldn't help you, even if you could talk about work. Nothing about you being an attorney or a doctor or a film star, which he's entertained a lot of those and musicians and what have you. Nothing about that's going to help you make the perfect sauce.
Souffle.
So,
yeah.
Right. So you have to actually interact on kind of a more human level. And it really leverages that multiplexity thing we were just talking about as well.
Just a quick cleanup here. I was referring to one of my guests. I said Samra April. I used her middle name. I'm sorry. It's Samra Stevenson. So if she hears that, she'll know I corrected it on the record.
Love it.
I'm going to close with a quote of yours, loosely quoted, not from your book, but from your latest TED Talk. And it's your final quote. And if you would allow me, I think you said something along the lines of, show me your friend of a friend, and I'll show you your future. And there's so much in that statement.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, yes, there is.
There's so much in that statement. It refers to probably 10 chapters of the book.
Yep.
And an idea that I don't think we think of, that you detailed in magnificent form, talking about how a remote connection can make a positive impact, even if you're not aware of that connection.
Or negative. I mean, that's and ultimately that is, to me, that was the reason for writing the book. I think a lot of people think, why should I care about networks and networking? Like, oh, I don't, it's so instrumental. It makes me feel icky, whatever. And that's true if you're thinking about it just instrumental. But the truth is, networks affect every element of your life. And in the book, we break down a couple different studies in the body of research known as the 3 degrees of influence. Nikos Christakis and James Fowler, two of the most brilliant network scientists of our age, studied a massive network. They built, using health data from the Framingham Heart Study, they built this massive network and then were able to see the way people's connections influence their health, right? And so the most famous study from this is that your friends really do make you fat. They do. But so do their friends.
I have a lot of friends.
I know, right? Well, no, it's not the number of your friends, but so do their friends, and so do their friends' friends. Yeah. So they found a statistically significant influence on you, even if you've never met that person. And the truth is, we have no idea why. We think it has something to do with sort of social norms and the way that the community you're in affects your behavior and what have you. But all we have right now is a couple different working theories. We don't know why, but we know it's not correlational. We know it's causative, and we know it's there. And I think that's a real reason. Again, if we're redefining networks, networking, not as meeting strangers, but by understanding the network you're already in, then it's totally about who is a friend already, work friend or personal friend. Doesn't matter because of multiplexity, but it also matters who's 1 or 2 degrees of separation away from you, because they're influencing you, but they're also the people you are destined to meet. So in so many different ways, it's not that trite little phrase that we always say, show me your friends and I'll show you your future. And it really is, show me your friend of a friend and I'll show you your future too.
I just thought that was such a powerful closing to your TED Talk. And I was just sitting there and went, wow, there's so much in that. And I'm glad that you had an opportunity to unpack it a little bit for us. Just mention the book again, Friend of a Friend, Understanding the Hidden Networks That Can Transform Your Life and Your Career. It's available everywhere. Books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, actual real bookstores.
It's available at fine retailers everywhere.
Everywhere.
And if they don't have it, it's because they are not a fine retailer.
There you go. If you can't get your hands on this book, you're not looking very hard, because it's readily available. I highly, highly commend it. It's one of the best books I've read in the last couple dozen years or so. I really enjoyed it that much, David, and I'm thrilled that you take the time to be on the show today with us. Tell our audience how they can reach out to you or how they can find out more about David Berkus.
So, I mean, the best place, if you're already listening to the show, is to check out the show notes for this episode, right?
There you go.
Because yep. Neil does a great job with it. But also, if you wanted to go to davidberkus.com, BURKUS.com, that'll take you there as well. But I know Neil will link to that in the show notes. So go there. He wants you to go to them anyway. He's just given up on asking you. So go there. You'll find that. I'm sure he'll link to all of the other stuff. And you'll even find ways to get in touch with me and keep the conversation going, because that's what matters. If you listen to this, then you are one of Neil's friends, which means you are one of my friend of a friend. So let's keep this conversation going.
Outstanding. David, thank you ever so much for being on The Law Entrepreneur. Well, that will do it for today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I'd like to thank our sponsors for making this show possible, the good folks at Call Ruby Receptionists, and our newest sponsor, Jurisdiction, the providers of the Next Level Law Practice Program. So take a moment to visit our show notes and hop on over to their websites for special discounts and savings and other free stuff that you can get, to just support them, because they make this podcast possible day in and day out. Also, if you got a couple minutes, pop on over to our own website, thelawentrepreneur.com. We have a couple little articles there. You can also listen to the podcast itself there if you choose to. And sign up for our newsletter or our mailing list. And we don't do a lot. You know, you're not going to bombard you with emails every week. And I do plan on doing a few more this year, but we'd love to have you join our community. And in that sense, you can also go on to our Facebook page. You can find us just by searching on The Law Entrepreneur. You can find out what we got going on a daily basis, sometimes hourly, on the Facebook page. So I'd love to have you join us there. And if you have the time, last but not least, go on over to iTunes, search on The Law Entrepreneur. And if it's something that you believe in and feel strongly about, we'd love for you to leave an honest 5-star review, as well as comments about what you like and dislike about the show, because it does mean a lot to us that you are our community, our listeners, and I want to thank you for making this all possible. So we'll see you next time on The Law Entrepreneur.